baffling. That's the take from the CEO of the American Booksellers Association. A big win, says Amazon, speaking not for the e-tailer, but it says for Kindle owners. An intrusion into the business sector by the federal government in a manner that is designed to bully people, declares, no, not a Republican candidate, but top agent Robert Gottlieb. And they are all talking about the U.S. Department of Justice move to sue Apple and five trade bookhouses for price fixing on e-books. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series, Beyond the Book. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week we speak with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first, as always, on the show is Andrew Albanese in PW's offices in New York City. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, clearly a momentous week, a stunning announcement, and one with repercussions that will be felt for months, if not years ahead. Tell us more.
Yeah, really a momentous week, and really quite a bad week, too, for publishers. As I'm sure we all know by now, on Wednesday, the DOJ, as you said, did file suit against five of the six publishers, the big six publishers, alleging an illegal conspiracy with Apple to artificially inflate ebook prices by switching nearly simultaneously to the agency model. Three publishers, Hachette, HarperCollins, and Simon & Schuster, have agreed to settle those claims without admitting any wrongdoing, but they are certainly going to pay a heavy price for having done nothing wrong.
So what do you mean heavy price? What's that going to look like to them?
Well, first, let's be clear. The agency model is not dead. And it's important to note that this case was never about the agency model. It was about how these five publishers got to the agency model. And the settlement is not designed to force any kind of fundamental reform on the ebook market, but mostly to punish these five publishers for their alleged conspiracy. So going forward, the three settling publishers can still use the agency model if they choose. But for a period of 2 years, they cannot actually dictate the final consumer prices, which was the allure of the agency model in the first place. In other words, the retailers must be free for the next 2 years to discount to consumers off the price that publishers sell to them. Now, here's the interesting part of this. Ebook retailers under this settlement are only free to lower consumer prices up to the amount of their commission under this agency model. Generally, that's 30% under the current terms. So, for example, if Amazon wants to cough up its 30% margin to enter into a price war, they can do so for 2 years. Now, that's not a terrible outcome for publishers because it at least sets a floor for any ebook price war. And it would seem on its face to prohibit retailers from selling books at a loss. But nevertheless, it's complicating. And of course, Random House and other agency publishers that weren't part of this alleged plot are free to keep doing agency business model deals as usual. The question for them is, can they? If three major publishers are lowering their prices or having their prices lowered, I should say, by 30%, can other publishers keep their prices high? Remember, this is at the heart of what the government alleges is going on here, that individually, no publisher could raise prices, but together they could.
Well, I have to say, Andrew, I love the use of the word plot. Usually we wait for Rose to come on and talk about plots in the reviews.
I was going to use the word cabal. But.
it's just remarkable to think about this going on. And there's a lot of detail in the charges about meetings and lunches and so forth. But now that this has all come out finally, and as you describe it, what's the real pain moving forward?
Well, the real pain here, in a word, is compliance. Each of the settling publishers here are going to have to engage in a number of compliance measures, and that includes the appointment of an antitrust compliance officer, training for relevant staff by an attorney, an annual compliance audit. The settling publishers also have to furnish to the DOJ on a quarterly basis electronic copies of any allegations alleging noncompliance. They have to maintain and furnish a log of all oral and written communications, excluding privileged or public communications, between any employees involved in ebook strategy. And think about that. A log of oral communications? That's just extraordinary. The DOJ can also invite itself over and poke around these publishers. The settling publishers are going to have to furnish copies of their books, their ledgers, accounts, records, data, any documents that the DOJ wants to look at regarding the settlement upon request. The DOJ can also interview any employees or agents of the company. The good news there, if you're tab stabbed, you get to bring your lawyer for $500 an hour or whatever the going rate is. And upon request, the publishers also have to submit written reports or respond to interrogatories and under oath if requested. So, you know, you get the picture. You know, having fun yet?
Yeah, really. People are going to love that. But this explains in part why at least, actually two publishers have decided to fight.
That's right. You know, Macmillan and Penguin are going to stick this out and fight it, apparently. But, you know, you're right. It sure does explain why they would want to fight on. Because really, could a court battle be any more onerous than the compliance measure I've just sort of ticked off here? I suppose, actually, yes, they really could be, especially in a fight with the government. Now, Penguin and Macmillan, their CEOs at least, are shouting their innocence, which is good. But I have to say, having these two publishers fight on while the others settle is shaping up to be the worst possible situation, at least in my opinion. You know, they all got in this together, whether or not it was done through any sort of conspiracy or legal conclusion, but now they are starting to fall apart. And, you know, why is this a questionable decision for Macmillan and Penguin? Well, the lawyers I've spoken to note that DOJ actions can take a long time. They tend to move pretty slowly. So this could end up being quite a battle for them. Now, for the other publishers who settled at the end of 2 years, they're going to know where they stand, more or less. Who knows where the market's going to be at that point. The question is, how long are Penguin and Macmillan going to fight this? And then, if at the end of that period they lose, what's their penalty going to look like? And where are the other publishers who settled going to be? So it's kind of a gamble. You know, I love the idea that the CEOs of Macmillan and Penguin want to fight for justice. But for shareholders, the path of least resistance always seems to beckon. And one other thing I should mention, too, if this action proceeds and Macmillan and Penguin do fight it out in court, they're going to get to take some shots at Amazon, too. You know, one of the things that was presented as fact in this complaint by the DOJ is that intense price competition among ebook retailers had driven the price of popular books to $9.99. Intense competition? You know, in 2009, Amazon had about, you know, 90% of the popular market, according to some estimates. And that doesn't sound like an advantage that was won from a price war. So I think that's just one perception of the, you know, or one part of the DOJ's perception of the book business that might end up being put on trial here.
Well, it really is fascinating. And as you describe it, the potential for being a drain on the industry at a moment when they can least afford it is striking. And there's one other player to talk about. We've mentioned Amazon. We've mentioned the publishing houses. But there's Apple, too.
Yeah. And Apple, though Apple remains defiant. Oh, of course they do. And let's be honest. I mean, speaking personally here and not for my, you know, esteemed employer, I think this is really all about Apple. You know, the case is laid out is all about publishers, but I really don't believe that's the case. And, you know, again, speaking for myself, I was totally bemused watching Eric Holder's press conference on Wednesday. He gave this impassioned talk about what a great consumer victory this was. And then the press pool came up and they had two very brief questions before they changed the subject to Trayvon Martin. Now, I know the Trayvon Martin story also heated up on Wednesday with charges. But by and large, my impression is that most consumers and indeed most media outlets don't really know much about this case or don't care. And you know, and for a prosecutor, I have to believe that nailing a publisher's pelt to their wall really isn't like the greatest big game they could be hunting. You know, it really seems to be about Apple. You know, really claiming ebook buyers are overpaying by a few bucks, you know, maybe it totals $100 million over 2 years among five firms. I find that warrants the kind of DOJ attention we're getting here. I find that really questionable. Now, I'm not condoning any actions by publishers that may be outside the law. I want to be clear about that. But what I'm saying is that this is, you know, not the subprime mortgage business or banking. Publishing is a low margin business, and as you said, they're in the midst of a historic transition. This isn't Wall Street. You know, so my suspicion is that the DOJ has been watching Apple for some time, that they were really the shiny brass ring, and publishers who've been, you know, sort of panicking over what they saw as a loss of pricing power stumbled into the picture. Now, you also mentioned dinner meetings and the wine cellar at Picholine and some of these other intriguing details that were in the complaint. And if those are true, it does seem like some CEOs at major publishing houses made some poor decisions, shall we say. But I find the DOJ action kind of stunning. And again, I'm speaking personally, because there's so many places where the government could intercede to make a much more competitive digital book market. We're talking about copyright reform, orphan works, DRM limitations, you know, regulating the odious click-on licenses, you know, fixing the inability of consumers to resell ebooks or share them or for libraries to lend them. You know, where is the government on these issues? In its complaint, the government touted all the great things ebooks can do, their convenience, and they spoke about them as products that are analogous to books, but they're not. The DOJ failed to note in its complaint all the things that ebooks can't do. Crucially, for example, that ebooks are not purchased by consumers, they are licensed, and that those licenses can be revoked, that Amazon can restrict these ebooks to their platform, that they can pull these ebooks from consumers if they suspect, not prove, but suspect of a license violation. You know, these are all, to me, much greater competitive issues for ebooks than price. And these are all issues that the government, I think, has ignored in this action, which makes this feel a heck of a lot less like a big consumer victory. You know, at the same time, this is also kind of an indictment of publishers, because of all the ways they had to try to foster more competition, they went right to price controls, right out of the gate. So, you know, a lot of this is their fault as well. But at this stage of the game, I'm confident saying, personally, again, price is not the big issue with ebooks. And to view the ebook market detached from the overall book market, to ignore Amazon's licensing and its platform lock-in strategy, to look at the market only through this prism of pricing and more specifically through antitrust, I question whether that's really the most effective approach to ensuring a robust market for consumers.
Well, interesting analysis there from Andrew Albanese. And I guess, you know, before we let you go, Andrew, I just want to ask you, how difficult is this trying to explain it to people who aren't following it on a day-to-day basis the way you do? It really gets obscure pretty fast, I think.
It gets obscure pretty fast. And I've found that almost everybody that I've tried to talk to about it outside of the publishing business knows very little about it. In fact, for most consumers, the only thing they know about ebooks is they cost a lot less than hardcovers. Not that the prices went up a little bit when the agency model came in. You know, I'm certainly not suggesting that pricing is not a big issue. It is. And I thank and I'm happy the DOJ is there watching pricing. But as you mentioned before, this is a critical time for the publishing industry. And this is a kind of a questionable action by DOJ at this point, in my opinion.
Well, it's the definition of a continuing story for everybody at Publishers Weekly. We're sure you'll have more with for us in the coming weeks. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And now I want to turn, as we always do, to Rose Fox, PW Reviews Editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
You're welcome, Chris. I'm going to try and make it a very peaceful and relaxing session today to counteract a little bit of that political hotheadedness that seems to be going on.
Well, we can look forward to that. But, you know, if we're going to start with fiction, it's going to be about relationships. And sadly, those are not always peaceful and fun.
That's true. In the fiction section this week, we review Paget Powell's You and Me. It's a novel consisting solely of dialogue between a couple of dime store philosophers. They're just hanging out, chewing the fat on a front porch. But as improbable as it sounds, he really makes it work. And we have a Q&A with him in a coming issue talking about how he makes it work. We also review Luann Rice's Little Night, in which two sisters become estranged. Anne's husband abuses her, Claire attacks him, and then Anne lies on the witness stand and Claire goes to jail. And the novel's about the ramifications of that. And we review The Forever Marriage by Anne Bauer, in which a woman slowly comes to terms with her husband's death and the difficulties of their marriage. So you're right, it's not always happy. But I think all of these stories have something in them, a little bit of hope, a little bit of thoughtful curiosity about relationships that keeps them going. And we have a Q&A with Sergio de la Pava. He's a public defender who writes what he knows in a naked singularity. And he talks about hating sunlight and why he's going to keep his day job. In the mystery thriller section, we have another Q&A with Ace Atkins, author of The Lost Ones, who talks about continuing Robert B. Parker's Spencer franchise and shelving books at Barnes & Noble. We review Burning Midnight by Lauren D. Esselman that takes P.I. Amos Walker to Detroit's Mexican town to investigate gang violence. It's the 22nd book in the series, and our reviewer says they continue to be just top-notch. We also review Zoe Ferraris's Kingdom of Strangers. This is the third novel starring a Saudi forensic technician, Katya Hijazi, who struggles with the conflicts between her professional life and her culture's view of the proper role of women.
Well, yeah, that's an intriguing conception there of a Saudi forensic technician, a woman, in that culture. Of course, not the expected role. That's a book I might want to pick up. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we've got a ghost figuring in one of the books.
Yeah, Advent by James Treadwell. This is one of those books that's really on the line between adult and young adult. The hero is 15 years old, and he sees ghosts, and he keeps talking about it until he gets suspended from school and ends up in this old mansion where it turns out a lot of other people with supernatural abilities are gathering, and they must contend with the resurrection of Faust. Yes, that Faust, the last Magus. So it's really, it's an incredible story full of really beautiful imagery. And we also review Kiss the Dead. This is Laurel K. Hamilton's 21st Anita Blake novel, and she comes through for her fans with her tried and true blend of bloody police work and athletic preternatural sex. Speaking of which, in the romance section, Along Came a Duke is a Regency romance by Elizabeth Boyle. It's a charming take on the Cinderella story in which a spirited scullery maid matches wits with a ne'er-do-well duke. And in comics, we have The Lovely Horrible Stuff by Eddie Campbell. It's a semi-autobiographical graphic novel. It feels like a night of conversation over many beers with a charming man. And in King City by Brandon Graham is a hilarious, touching romp about an ordinary fellow named Joe and his marvelously mutable, drug-fueled cat, whose name is Earthling J. Cattingsworth III.
Well, in nonfiction, we've got several appearances in books by the Obamas.
Yeah, I said I was going to keep this apolitical, and clearly I'm falling down on the job here. We have a Q&A with James Mann, author of The Obamians, who talks about the ebbing of Vietnam's legacy and the major foreign policy challenges that Obama would face if elected to a second term. In American Tapestry, the story of the black, white, and multiracial ancestors of Michelle Obama, this is a layered, scrupulously researched, and wrenching chronicle of First Lady Michelle Obama's ancestry. And New York Times reporter Rachel L. Swarns takes readers to South Carolina rice plantations, small Georgia farms, and the industrial magnates of Birmingham and Chicago. And we have The Price of the Ticket by Frederick C. Harris, which puts Obama's 2008 presidential campaign in the context of the rise of black politics in the 20th century. And it discusses the conflicts between politics of confrontation and politics of accommodation. Also in nonfiction, we have In the Hour Between Dog and Wolf, in which neuroscientist and former Wall Street trader John Coates shows that Wall Street is dominated by primitive drives and hormonal surges. And this treatise on the neurobiology of the business cycle draws an intimate portrait of life on the trading floor as an almost physical athleticism directed by brain processing and chemistries evolve for less cerebral pursuits. And we have a Q&A with Richard Lloyd Parry, author of People Who Eat Darkness, and he talks about how he investigated the curious case of a young Western woman who was killed in Japan.
In the lifestyle section, there's a book just for me, I think, because it's for chefs with small kitchens.
And you have a bit of a sweet tooth, too, Chris?
Well, my guest will. I tend to stay away from that. So I'm more of a savory character. But tell me about this book here.
Well, for your guest, then, we have Keir Jensen's The Sugar Cube. That's the name of her food cart in Portland, Oregon. And the book compiles 50 recipes for a wide range of desserts and sweets. And because she makes them in a small space, you know, her food cart that she's trundling around the streets, this is really perfect for new bakers and cooks with tiny kitchens and very few fancy tools. Also in the lifestyle section, we have Leslie Ann Bester's Cast On, Bind Off. It's an excellent reference guide for starting and ending a piece of knitting, so I might be picking that one up myself. In the children's section, we have a three-page spread, 23 reviews of board books. That's not boring books. Those are books with boards. Those are for babies and early readers. Really wide range. There are some very excellent titles. Also, the heroine of Naoko Stoop's gorgeously illustrated Red Knit Cap Girl enlists the help of forest creatures as she looks for a way to talk to the moon. And in children's fiction, Elizabeth Wine's Codename Verity is a riveting and often brutal tale set in World War II, in which a captured Scottish spy relates her story while being tortured by Nazis. And I'm told that one has a hell of an ending, so brace yourself. In children nonfiction, we have The Letter Q, edited by Sarah Moon and James Lacine. It's a thoughtful, humorous, and moving collection of works in which 64 queer authors and artists share hope and advice with their younger selves. In our online annex this week, we review The Not Yet by Moira Crone. This takes place in New Orleans in the year 2121, where the wealthy elite are immortal thanks to medical advances, but all is not peachy keen. And as you might imagine from a book about New Orleans set in New Orleans, there are a lot of class differences to contend with. And our pick of the week is Office Girl by Joe Mano. It's a sweet story of two 20-something doyens of pop culture and their frustrations and quirks. And that's it for the reviews.
Well, Rose Fox, thank you indeed. Always a pleasure to hear about the reviews coming up in this week's PW. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Andrew Robinies, I guess we'll be talking to you from London next week. Well, you'll be at the London Book Fair.
That's right. And you can look for ongoing coverage of the London Book Fair and PW Daily.
We look forward to that. Have a great trip.
Thanks.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.